All right. I'm going to go ahead and start. I actually have a conflict at 2, so I really, it's like a set hour that I can be with you here today, and then I have to take off. But if you have any other questions, of course, you can continue to email me or post on Twen. I feel like the best use of your time is to give you a few general suggestions up front, then to dive into those practice questions, because I think talking about it in the context of what you need to know is the best thing to do. Then I'll answer the questions I got extraneously from the ones that aren't going to fit in the practice problems. To be honest, most of the questions that were raised really are addressed in a lot of the problems that I'm going to cover right now. If we can't get to all those questions, because I got about like 15 emails at like 11:50, I will summarize and post those on Twen. So they will all get answered. It's just I'm trying to pick the format that's best conducive to this kind of a review to do those kinds of questions here. All right, general suggestions. After having met with several of you about the midterm, I would say, you know, I remember being a student. I know you've got a lot of things going on. It's tough. You're trying to hedge your bets about what you need to, you know, cover and don't cover. One of the cardinal sins, mistakes you should never make is assuming, like, she's never going to ask me that. And so don't, like, especially, like, put too much weight on any one part of the problem. I think in rules, the temptation is to do, like, if I post a practice problem, like, only cover that rule. If I didn't post one, another one, well, she's not going to ask about that. That's just not a good rule of thumb. All right, so what is maybe a better way to kind of go about doing it? I would say that clearly these are the two major big categories, the joinder of parties and claims and the motions, and so you should be, I would say, at least equally comfortable with these sections. Some things test better in multiple choice format than they do in essay. Some things test better in essay than they do multiple choice. That really shouldn't affect the amount of time you study for it, though. But if you are coming down to the end and you're running out of time and you just have to, you know, what can I do that gets the best return? Here's two big suggestions. One is make sure you have a basic canned rule statement for all the rules we cover in class. If nothing else, if you understand the basic operation of a rule, you're at least going to get those points. That being said, like, there's some exceptions that might mean that you're missing here and there, but I'll tell you, people who tend to not do as well tend to miss all of those points. And if you get the basic root points, you generally put yourself in at least that, like, not as difficult range, right? So you're already helping yourself out and making sure you have that. The second thing is there's a lot of outlining you could do right now and a lot of other, you know, looking for extra problems outside of the ones I gave you. I tend to find that at this point in time, that tends to be more of a waste of your time. What I would say you need to do the most of is answering, actually writing out, like not answering, talking to a friend, bullet pointing your answer, but actually answering the questions I've given you. Okay, so that includes any on the worksheets, any on the PowerPoints. And the reason's this. I think because I've, you know, taught for quite a few years now and have gone through many iterations of these exams, the thing I hear most consistently is, I understand the law. I'm just not telling it to you. And I do really believe that it's true. I think there are people who, if I ask them a question, I direct the question to them, if they can spit back the answer to me. But that's not what any of us are going to ask you to do on your exam. What we're going to do is give you a situation you haven't seen, ask you to identify the rules that are there, and provide written answers to it. So the more you practice outside of what I'm actually asking you to do, the less effective your practice is. If you can write out answers and describe them in the way that you should get for the actual exam, you'll get much more understanding of the rules than just drilling the rules or memorizing your outline or anything like that. Your outline is a tool to answer questions. So don't spend all your time at the end just perfecting the tool and never doing what it's supposed to do, which is help you get to answer questions. All right, so let's talk about some of those questions that I gave you. The ones I gave you for this review session, there's like several fact patterns. I tried to pull a sampling of my old exams that show both some situations dealing with joinder claims, joinder parties, and some of the motions. All right, it's not a sample of everything. I mean, we would be here for way more than an hour. So let's talk about these. The other thing I was going to let you know is I've also, in speaking with Gillis, found a couple more old questions, examples on, like, default, which I've had several questions about that I'll be posting on Twen. So you should have at least, you know, some practice problem for literally everything we've done. Okay, so the first question, Alice purchasing her home, is a question about summary judgment. And so if you look at the question, it asks you, you're a law clerk to the judge hearing the matter, advise the judge as to how he or she should rule on Inspector Doofus's motion for summary judgment. And there's a couple key things you should think about. First of all, because it's a rules-based course, your answer should outline the process in the rule. So you could talk about negligence and all that stuff. It'll just pull you off course. Focus on the rule itself. So this is Rule 56, since it's a summary judgment motion. And I identify it for you. So aside from numbering 56, most of the points come in the application of the aspects of the rule. So the first thing you want to do is talk about the standard under 56A for summary judgment motions, which remember is that there's no genuine dispute of material fact, and that the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. And no matter what you do from here, you need to make sure, this would be like one of those core parts of your answer, no matter what you do with summary judgment, you should have that standard clearly articulated. What doesn't get you points, kind of saying, in general, this is where people can take their case from the jury, or summary judgment is about the following. You know, those kinds of statements are good for you to understand so you can spot an issue spot and identify things like policy statements, but those don't generally, most exams, get you much points. What gets you points is like the rule and its application. So these words I'd want to make sure are in your answer. You'd want to then apply to the situation and what are the things he's trying to say that there's no genuine dispute about. There's two. One is that there's no professional standard of care provided. That's part of the duty or the breach, however you like to put it. Doesn't matter to me in Civil Pro class. Maybe it matters in tort class, but it's that element of her claim, and then that she wasn't filing within the statute of limitations. And so you'd want to talk about both, how he articulates there's no genuine dispute, and why that entitles him to judgment as a matter of law. So for that, you want to move to what's the process he has to do to show these things. The rule only speaks to process about this, about how you put things into genuine dispute, how you take them out and show there is no genuine dispute. The movement being entitled to judgment as a matter of law is really a question of the substantive law and its application. So if I was to wait on Civ Pro, how long I'd spend on either part of this question? Probably this one, since there's more actual process outlined in the rules for it, right? So this is 56C, 1A and B, okay? And we look in the fact pattern and we figure out which route he took. I got a lot of questions about this. So realize as a movement, there's several things you can do. Under A, you can show by demonstrating citation to specific aspects of the record that that there is no genuine dispute of a material fact. So you have to figure out what that fact, you know, it's material, and now cite to the record and show that it that we've shown it doesn't exist. That's not what he's doing here. He's doing 56C1B, which is basically demonstrating that by looking to the facts and sellotext, what's been shown in discovery, that she is not going to be able to meet her burden at trial, since she's the plaintiff, in establishing her elements. And also the statute of limitation is inviolated. So your answer should include then how he's doing that. And so you want to talk about in sellotext that it's more than just resting on your pleadings. It's more than just saying they can't do it, prove your case. It's by doing some discovery and then demonstrating through that discovery that there will be an absence of facts on which she could prevail. That there's anything that's in anything that's disputed is not going to assist her, and everything else is not in dispute and favors judgment as a matter of law for me. So here's how the application would look. We've already identified what our material things are. It's that professional standard of care and the statute of limitations. How has he done this? Well, he did 3 months of discovery. And you'd want to point that. That's a fact there. He did some discovery. What did he point to? Discovery documents, answers, interrogatories, and all the depositions taken thus far have no expert testimony about due care of discovering asbestos. And so literally, from the fact pattern, lift those words and put in your answer that that is how he's demonstrating, showing the absence of material or absence of dispute about that material fact, about the standard of care. Okay? You say, you know, it's more than just saying it's his pleadings. He's actually done something. He's demonstrated that there's an absence of dispute about that. But there's no expert here who will testify or be able to give us that it was improper to not recognize asbestos under the situation he did. Then you also want to do that because he has two different grounds. This is the standard of care grounds. You want to do it on the statute of limitations grounds. But there's nothing in the record after looking at the depositions, the interrogatories, and any other answers we have that shows she filed her claim within the statute of limitations. All right. And so for the first bit of the answer, you have your standard. You identify which facts you say are not in dispute. And then the last, and how he did it, this is the how he did it, the process part. And then your last statement will be, and he's entitled then to judgment as a matter of law, at least he's established thus far that he is, because if she can't prove the standard of care in a professional negligence case, she will not prevail in her claim. Alternatively, if she can't show she files within the statute of limitations, her claim will be barred, both of which will entitle me to judgment as a matter of law. All right, we're still not done with this question, but that's the first bit of it. So you can see kind of the difference already between first semester midterm level questions and these ones, is that there's a lot more process with one issue. Because a motion has a lot more process to it than like simply filing the answers in response to declarations and a complaint, for example. There's just more to it. So the best thing you can do is break it into its pieces. Our standard, our process. Now we're going to flip and do the person who responds to the motion. What's the standard? What's the process they're going to use? But before I do that, I just want to make sure we don't have any questions on the answer thus far. Anything so far? Okay. So then I want to have my answer. Then the next issue is, now that he's done this, how has Alice responded? Because we're supposed to advise the judge as to whether or not to grant or deny Doofus's motion. So Alice has now the same standards. You don't have to re-articulate to say it's under the same issue, but she's trying to show that there is a genuine dispute and that he's not entitled to judgment as a matter of law. All right? Because she's opposing the summary judgment motion. She can do it in either way. Even saying, well, even if you take everything as he says, that he's not entitled to judgment as a matter of law, was that fruitful at all for her in this case? No, because right now everything's going in his favor, and if she didn't show statute of limitations, and if she didn't show standard care, she would lose. So she's going to do this. She's going to put stuff in dispute. And so we say, that's our first part. This thing now for Alice is she's trying to create a genuine dispute about, and then list out the two facts that, you know, that you've identified as being material, the standard of care of inspectors and the statute of limitations. Okay? And then show, just like we did for Doofus, standard process. You want to show standard of the motion, then process under the motion. And it's the same process, 56C, but now instead of C1B, it's C1A. I'm going to come over here. The C1B is about like pointing out stuff and saying, yeah, that's not good enough. C1A is about putting things into dispute or putting in evidence to show there is no dispute. It's about putting stuff in. B is about showing what's there is not sufficient, either because it doesn't create a genuine issue material fact or because there is a genuine issue material fact if you look at it. So this is Alice's process is 56, C1A. Again, for my purposes, it's just 56C that you have to cite to me. But just when you're going to review this, what it is. And she has to do the same thing. She has to cite to the record now to show there is genuine dispute, a material fact. The nice thing about when you start your answer from the top and move down is that since you've already identified the facts of standard of care and statute of limitations are material facts, that's not, you don't need to reprove that here. You're just doing what's new, which is that it's in genuine dispute now. Doofus was saying it wasn't through his process. Alice is saying that stuff is in dispute. And how does she do it? Does she do it properly? Here, she creates affidavits and submits them. They're from two different people. One's an expert in inspection, and one's her. All right? So there's little sub-points here. We'll get to those in a second. Let's get the big points out first, which is this fitting the process? Well, the process is, you know, showing in the record that there is stuff into a genuine dispute? And is this a showing? Yes, because affidavits are what you can submit under 56C1A. The extra points are the affidavit rules. Do these fit affidavits? And so, like, this would be, like, the A plus A, solid A answer. If you just got through the process and didn't do the sub-points on affidavits, you'd still do very well. But let me show you the greatest sophistication in an answer would be pointing out that these things are okay. One, they're made on personal knowledge. Secondly, they set forth facts that would be admissible as evidence. And three, the affiant is competent to testify to the matters therein. Remember the standards for an affidavit? And so you'd give those and spell out why both she and the expert witness that she has, so her own and her expert, are okay as affidavits. They meet that standard, okay? But again, we're talking about, like, the ultimate points, all right? A really good answer may not necessarily have done that, but have pointed out the good answer that's going to do well would have to point out that affidavits are part of the showing under 56C1A. Do you see the difference in kind of like the level of answer that would be? All right, good. All right, so in the end, is this going to be sufficient? Well, the question of whether or not we have a genuine dispute in the end is, could a reasonable jury decide or disagree about this, decide either way? And could a reasonable jury dispute or disagree about whether or not there was sufficient demonstration of the standard of care? I mean, like, could they have found that Doofus fell beneath the standard of care based on the expert's affidavit? And the answer is yes. You know, they don't have to, but all we're trying to do now is, we don't give you summary judgment if a reasonable jury could look at that and say he failed to meet the standard of care, which is the breach question. Could a reasonable jury on the statute of limitations also do the same? And this is where most students went awry. And I think it's just their understanding of statute of limitations. It's discovery-based, and so since she's in her affidavit saying, I didn't discover it, that a reasonable jury could either believe her or not. Right? They could say, nope, we don't believe you. Yes, we do. And that's the discovery rule to statute of limitations. All right? The good thing is, the more you spell stuff out in CivPro terms, if you have a bobble with something like tort law or contract law or something else, it's, I follow your CivPro reasoning. So it behooves you to explain using the civil procedure doctrine of, you know, could a reasonable jury look to these things and conclude either way? That way, if you have, like, a statute of limitations snafu, I don't really care. I mean, of course, I care, but not for purposes of scoring you, right? All right, so just focus on the civil procedure terms. And that's the way to not panic about anything like that. I'll follow you through your CivPro reasoning. All right, and that's actually the sum total of that answer. So in the end, your conclusion should be no summary judgment because there is a genuine dispute over these material facts, which is the standard of care, whether he fell beneath it, and the statute of limitations, whether or not she had actually discovered the defect in time such that the filing was within the statute of limitations or not. Okay? A different kind of question on summary judgment could come out a different way. This isn't the only way you can answer summary judgment. So I got some questions about different ways you can go through it. The route that we took was actually the Celotex route, where the person who's moving is the person who doesn't bear the burden at trial. It is really trying to say, based on the discovery done thus far, there's an absence of things that the non-movement, the person with the burden of proof in the end, needs to win on, like an element of her claim or a defense that's essential, like the statute of limitations. It's a bar on your claim. All right, so that's that route. The other route a movement could make, either someone who carries the burden at court ultimately in the trial or not, is to do kind of this route where you show affirmatively that there is no genuine dispute or show affirmatively that there is through 56C1A. So if you're the movement, you can just demonstrate, look at all these things together. All this together shows that there's no genuine dispute of material fact. All right? So in the end, I kind of had these, if you look to the second day on the summary judgment slides, they're the slides that are entitled, What Options Does Reckless Have? What Options Does Parsons Have? And if you follow those, it's either, if you're moving, you can either, if you're the person doesn't bear the burden at trial, you can either go sell a tax and say, they bear the burden of proof, and they're never going to be able to meet it. Or you could take a route with, okay, they bear the burden of proof, but let me show you based on what we've seen that there's no genuine dispute over these issues, and I'm entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Those are the two major routes. And then I think that was the only other question I got about 56 was about the burden of proof at trial. And the question was, you know, how do you figure that out? What is the burden at trial? Well, that's an evidence issue, and I'll tell you, you should always presume it's preponderance of the evidence. That is generally the standard in all civil cases. But I'm not going to ask you about that, because to me, all I want you to know is that's what applies to the court when they're deciding whether or not to take this from the jury. You know, when they're deciding whether or not a reasonable jury could disagree. The test, the lens they look through is the standard at trial. So remember, burdens of proof are how certain do we have to be? Clear and convincing, we have to be more certain than we do in preponderance of the evidence. So when we're saying, could a reasonable jury disagree, if we're under a higher standard, it means they can only disagree if truly at a higher critique, a higher view of this evidence, we could actually disagree. But most civil cases, it's preponderance of the evidence, 51%. Could a reasonable jury, looking at it that way, with that level of certainty, come out either way? Don't understand that. So again, I'm not going to ever ask you in this case what kind of standard should they use at trial. That's like evidence class. This is just if we use clear and convincing, should I use it in summary judgment? The answer should always be yes, you should. Because we're trying to supplant the jury's role, so we can't do it on less than what they could have given judgment on. Okay, it's only if they could have given you judgment under the standard, then we can give it to you in summary judgment. All right. Summary judgment is tricky. I think if you write that one out, it makes it a little bit easier, but that's a good kind of example question. The big things to point out when you're looking at fact patterns, here's just a couple tips. If you read it how I wrote it, it really does, if you follow the fact pattern, this paragraph is this part of the answer. The paragraph that follows it is that part of the answer. So it's really try not to make it harder than it is. I'm really trying to get you to use the facts I've given you and actually use them. A lot of times people will just like skim over stuff, not actually use it. I mean, your application is really taking these facts and plugging them into the rule. That's where you get the points. It's really, honest to goodness, that's what I'm looking for. Okay? All right. Second question on there is a series that came from 2004. These were the only essays on this exam. The first one was not from that same exam. And it was a three-hour exam, too, so just to give you an idea. So they're a bit longer. But let's talk about two. This is the ticket broker series, and basically you're talking about two people who agree to go into buying, like, raffle tickets. They say they're going to split the money, split the proceeds in the end, and ultimately one of them runs away with the money. So the first question is about a person who's not party to the dispute. You got Betty. You got Rose. Rose was not part of the dispute. Why not? Because Betty took the money. She didn't want her to be part of the dispute. She's suing the ticket company to say, you should have paid me on my winning ticket. They said there's fraud in the ticket dispute, which comes up in the later questions, and so they're not paying Betty. So the question is, what about Rose? And so right away, this is a good way to issue spot for joining of parties of absent parties. Okay, so they're not party disputes. So you get points right away of indicating this is not a party, and it's about joining a non-party. All right, there's only very few routes you can use to joining a non-party. The difference about them generally is, do they want to be there or not? Are they trying to move themselves in, or are we saying that they were necessary and had to be added? But the analysis, in a lot of ways, is very similar, because it's the same general types of considerations we make under both. This one, she's trying to join herself, so this is intervention. So right off the bat, there's some points to, this is a Rule 24, if you call it intervention, and if you say Rose is the absent person who wants to be joined. Right away, you're already getting some of the basic points. Okay, so don't cut these out of your answer. She's the absent person who wants it. All right? So like I said, if you're like, you know, running out of time trying to figure out what to do with rules, even if all you had were the basic permutations of what intervention is, and you can spot it somewhere, you're going to get at least those core points that you can then make up ground in other essay questions. What you don't want to do is not have at least a basic canned answer for all the issues so that you miss all the points, right? You know, that's the harder to make up elsewhere. All right. So for intervention, it breaks into two pieces. And you note, I asked the students in this year to advise them of the process. So that's actually like how you intervene in addition to whether you can intervene. I think the process part's easier to answer second. Like every question for any kind of, whether it's joiner motion or motion to dismiss, I think it's easiest to start out with the standard. You know, on what grounds do we dismiss for summary judgment? On what grounds do we join someone in intervention? And then talk about, did they do the process right? I think that's easier. But you can answer however you want, okay? So if we talk about the grounds for intervention, there's intervention as of right, and there's permissive intervention. And the best answer would have at least reference to both and discuss them. All right, especially since I said, explain your reasoning fully on the question. All right, that's generally my indication of, I know there's alternate routes, and I want both. So I'm giving you the big secret. Whenever I put explain your reasoning fully, I generally mean, there's more than one way. Tell me both. All right? Okay, so as of right, how do you do this? Well, the rule is it's either a statute gives you that unconditional right to intervene, or you have something where you're claiming an interest related to the transaction. As a practical matter, the person who's not there's interest will be impaired or impeded, and they're not adequately represented. Okay, so how do you go about writing this rule statement? Do you need to have both the statute piece and the application of the other, if you don't fit a statute? Well, here, I tell you in the fact pattern, there are no statutes. None that apply. And the reason I'm doing that is I want to cut you down as far as time goes. So you don't have to tell me, hey, there's a thing, if we had a statute, that you could get in, because that's not going to get you any points. So just focus on the rule that you think is really at issue between both of them. And that's the second piece, all right? Which is there an interest? Will it, as a practical matter, be impaired or impeded? And are you otherwise adequately represented? Since there's three pieces, what's the best thing to do as far as writing the answer out? Write them as three different subpoints and apply each one. Okay. What I noticed in the midterm a lot was that people would think one issue is more important than another, or would just, I think, sometimes get lost because they'd see one issue and forget that the others were there. If you have your, you know, canned rule statements going in, you're less likely to do that, and you can do one of two things. You can either do the rule and then make sure you clearly tell me which piece you're applying, or you can do each rule application. I think the latter tends to be easier because it takes out of the equation any confusion I might have about which part of the rule you're applying. So let me show you how it works here. Okay, there's those three pieces to intervention under 24. Let's show how you do it if you broke it down. First, you'd say as of right. You can give me the general rule. You can say first we need to identify whether she has an interest related to the transaction. And then what you do is apply it. What is her interest? Her interest here is in the cash prize and in being the promotional model. The second thing you have to do is show that your interest will, as a practical matter, be impaired or impeded. Notice I'm using the actual rule language, practical matter, impaired or impeded. It has to be part of your answer to get full credit. And then apply that. And so what you'd say is here, the cash would be given away in total to Betty if she won. And the promotional model, since we're assuming that's one model, would be Betty and not Rose. So as a practical matter, for both of those reasons, it's impaired. Now, it was a cash prize. It wasn't like a damage payout that you can keep paying out. It was like a lump sum, like a limited fund kind of thing. And in that year, I had done a lot of hypos on, like, cash prizes in comparison to limited funds. So that's why I used it. But that's the analogy you draw, and that's what you'd say. And say, well, practically, hey, if they award it to Betty, there's no more prize money. It's all Betty's. Or if they give her the promotional model slot, there's no more, I'm not going to get my picture taken. I'm not going to be a promotional model. And that's really what the application looks. And the third part of the rule is, additionally, you have to show that there's not going to be adequate representation in the suit already. So what does that mean? You got to look at everyone that's there and rule them out. What's the common mistakes? You get to practical impairment, and you're like, I remember this part of the rule. I'm done, and forget the third element. Or talk about why Betty's not good to represent your interests, but forget about the other parties. Those are the big mistakes most people make, common ones. So practically impaired, impeded, why can't they represent you? Well, how good of a representative is Betty going to be? She said, hey, let's go and have these, and she runs off without you. I don't think she's going to be the best person to make sure that Rose's interests are taken care of. Now, the ticket people might have been, but in this fact pattern, I said that they don't even want to pay Betty. So are they going to be arguing Rose is entitled to any money? No, they said the whole thing got messed up. No one gets any money. It was a fraud on the ticket sales. So neither people in the suit already are going to protect Betty. So I think that's the easiest way to go about doing it. Do you see how we do, like, part of the rule, apply it, part of the rule, apply it, part of the rule, apply it? I truthfully think that's true of most exams, to be honest, not just mine, but do whatever you want in every class. Follow what they tell you. All right. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, you're like someone like, look, I can't, if I don't write down my rule statement, now, I'm going to be the person who's like, what was that third piece? And that's fine. This is what you do. You write the rule block, but it helps if you at least bullet or number the pieces, because then you'll remember yourself to go back and make sure when I read it, I know what you're talking about. Because here, what could bleed together? Practical impairment and whether there's adequate representation. Unless you're telling me clearly what you're talking about, sometimes the analysis gets mushy. You want to make sure it's much more plug and chuck, especially Civ Pro. It's very, yes, there's an answer, it's right or wrong, and it's very, like, it's very technical writing. It's not creative. It's very plug and chuck. Rudimentary. A plus B equals you win. That's what I want to see. Literally. Okay? So I think it helps to break it up. But you can do whatever you want. What you don't want to do, never practice which route you're going to take and assume that on the day of the exam you're going to be like, I will have an epiphany. I will sit down and I will know how to write A plus B equals C. It just doesn't happen. In my practice, I can tell you, I can count on maybe one finger the amount of students who told me that that's happened to them. Everybody else is like, I thought I would get it because I knew the answer. And I could have told you why Rose needed to be joined. If you asked me, I could tell you it, but I never actually practiced writing it. So what happens is it doesn't read that way, and you don't do as well. You're always going to end up in the middle, at least, or nothing really better than that middle block if you don't practice. Okay. So that's the as of right. Permissive, what you need to do is the same thing. Give me the rule application and apply it. It's pretty easy. Now it's just that you have to have a claim or defense and for the absent person. And the action have something in common and a common question of law or fact. What's the claim or defense in common? Who owns the ticket? Is the contest valid? You can point out both. You can point out one. It doesn't matter. Find something because you only need one. And the last thing is, since it's permissive, so this one's really easy. It's like two sentences kind of answer at the end after you guys are right. Is it's discretionary, so you have to show why adding this person won't cause undue delay or prejudice. And that's the last bit of Rule 24. No undue delay or prejudice. Why won't it cause undue delay? Well, in the fact pattern, it tells you immediately after the trip. Whenever you see, this is another trick, whenever you see exams and you read words, especially if it's a process-based exam, that say, on the third day, right afterwards, months later, you need to highlight those words because they're operative. Okay? It's not like a story I'm telling you. Like, oh, you know, one day, blah, blah, blah. But that's how people approach it. Because they almost, and I can tell you universally, in like the middle grouping and below, I'll never find those facts in their pattern when they write the answer. So make sure, be like a sleuth. Look for those kinds of things. Highlight it when you're reading through and go, that's got to come up somewhere. All right, it's got to come up somewhere. And that's where you put it. So since it was immediate, no undue delay. Second part, no prejudice. Because Betty was the one who tried to commit fraud, it's certainly not going to prejudice any party if Rose comes in. I had a couple people argue Betty's going to be really prejudiced because she doesn't want Rose in there. Well, of course she doesn't want Rose in there, but that's not the prejudice we're talking about. You know, you can't be like, well, the defrauder can get away. They can say the person's going to point out my defraud and that will prejudice me. That's just, you've got a bad case. The kind of prejudice we're talking about is somehow they're going to bring up a whole lot of other things that make the case get sluggish and slow. It's process prejudice, not she's going to have a better argument than mine prejudice. All right. Okay, so that's that question. And then the last two we've got here are different kinds of joinder. Question two is about claim joinder, and it's a real short one. And question three is about rule joinder parties, and it's rule 14. So let's talk about two first. I'm sorry, question three here. Discuss whether Ticketmaster's may or must bring these claims, and so it's claim joinder. What you want to do is talk about, you know, the position of the parties to identify whether you've got cross claims or counterclaims, because that's going to be the may piece of the compulsory counterclaim. Here, it's Betty and Tickets, and Tickets is trying to raise two different things. One, that there's fraud because she created a fake raffle ticket, and the second, that she posted all these like libelous statements about them everywhere. The first one is a compulsory counterclaim because it arises out of the same transaction or occurrence. And so the key facts you're looking for in this fact pattern are that they relate to the actual raffle ticket. So they're saying, I don't owe you any money on this. And then as an actual claim, and better yet, you actually defrauded our whole ticket thing. You owe us. So that's compulsory. And that's really all the answer is. The second one you do is then talk about the next claim. Give the rule. We got opposing parties, so we're in the counterclaim area. And is it compulsory or permissive? Well, the rule is, it's compulsory if it's out of the same transaction or occurrence as the other claim. If it's not, it's permissive. Is this out of the same transaction or occurrence? No. Well, there's some relationship, it'd be very loose. So if you thought maybe, hey, it's close enough, as long as you're doing some application of same transaction or occurrence and spelling it out, that helps. Now, if you conclude it and you think it's kind of like in the middle, you might want to say, however, even if it's not compulsory, they're still permitted to bring it under 13B. Yeah, and that's really what that is. I did give some bonus points to people who said the first claim was compulsory, and then you could use Rule 18 to add the other claim. But you should realize in things like claim joinder, there are several permutations of how the answer goes, and I give alternate pathways to the same total number of points. So here's how not to waste your time. You don't want to over-answer a short question like this by exposing every single alternative route, because you're going to do like the triple helix dismount and still get 10 points. It's the person who does the straight compulsory permissive. But if you're sort of in that, gosh, I thought of it as compulsory and Rule 18, I'm worried, you know, weeks later when you're still waiting for exam scores, what's going to happen? Well, the reality is I follow both routes. They both equal 10. All right? Does that make sense? Now, if you have extra time and you want to show me with great finesse, hey, look what else I can do, that's fine. But my guess is that's not going to happen. So just work on the straight-up answer you think is the most accurate and realize I follow the routes and they ultimately get to the same number of points. If they are the same. You know, you can't make up a route if it's not there. Yes.
Right?
Yes, which is why, like, in some ways you're going to have to choose. And it's why both routes get you the same amount of points. All right. Okay, last question. Is a Rule 14 joinder. The other example of this you have already is the practice problem based on records. So if you're kind of confused about party joinder, that was an exercise I used to make students do in class. We actually had an oral argument. I made them file a brief. This year you guys seemed a little bit tired by the time we finished the midterm. And those years I don't give midterms, so I didn't make you do a brief. But you could do it, and it would be like a test question on Parsons versus Reckless. That's already been posted, so you can look that one over. Here's another one, but it's the same fact pattern, same answer. So ultimately here, the way that you can join Rose if Betty wanted to, now that she's being sued for defrauding the ticket company, she's in a defending posture, and she's trying to bring Rose in under Rule 14. I actually thought this one was a really good, tricky Rule 14 question because most people didn't think of the plaintiff as being in the defending posture. So as far as complicated, like how difficult is a question, this is probably as hard as you're going to see. This is a hard question. Candidly, it's a hard question. Okay. And I didn't mean it to be as hard as it was, but it was. So let's talk about it. All right, joining Rule 14. You identify that it's a person in a defending posture. They may implead, and you get points for that too. A person who's not a party, who is or may be liable to the person who's bringing them in, so here to Betty, for all or part of the claim against her. And here I spelled out what that claim was. It's the tickets claim.
for fraud on the ticket sales. And she's saying Betty is, or Rose is, or may be liable to me for this claim. Now, where people go most wrong with Rule 14, they don't understand the underlying is or may be liable to me for the claim. And what this is, it really is only a few situations. What you're saying is our entire liability relationship depends on this claim. You're liable to me for this, not for other things. All right, so when can you be liable to someone for another claim? Really in two situations, contribution and indemnity. All right, I got some questions about this, so I'm going to address those right now. Like people going back through their tort understanding of, you know, so this only works in a joint and several liability, and the answer is yes. Because in joint and several liability, the idea is you're paying for someone else's potential loss, and they give you a right of contribution. So in that situation, you're saying, let's assume it wasn't a fraud in a ticket thing, but it was like a car accident again, just for purposes of ease. What you'd be saying is, Betty, I might pay out everything to the person we hit, but you are also responsible. It's not just that you're responsible as a tortfeasor, but that I'm going to overpay, and that you will owe me in contribution. Under a non-joint and several jurisdiction, whether your professor calls that comparative fault or proportional share or whatever they call the non-joint and several in your torts class, the answer is you don't have a Rule 14 claim because there's no contribution right. You only pay the percentage of fault that you are. No matter what. If he's 80% fault, he's only going to pay 80%. It's only in a joint several where we're going to say 80% at fault, pay 100. Okay? And so that's when it comes up. That's the tort one. Indemnity comes out of contracts, generally. It can come out in some other situations, but we focus primarily on that. That's what you should know. All right? So this question, flipping away from the car accident back to here, is about that liable claim, posting all those signs. Her first argument is that Rose should be joined because it was really Rose who put up the signs and not me. Now, this is an exact permutation of a camp example we did in class then and we did in class now, which is the finger point. If you sued the wrong guy. Will Rule 14 ever be used for you sued the wrong person, they really hit you with my car? No. You sued the wrong person because they really posted the signs? No. All right, so that's what the answer to that first one is. The second one is, she says, Rose may be liable to me because of that contract where she said we agreed to indemnify each other. Now, what don't I care about? Whether or not that's actually an indemnity claim, whether or not the contract would hold up in court, whether it's void or not void, that's just a horse. I care that equals Rule 14. And that's it. So it's actually a short question. Just give me the standard. That's what my answer should always be. The standard, and then go about it. What this question didn't get into is whether or not she did the process as well. But you could have answered that if I said, now, did she also follow the Rule 14 process? You'd say you have to serve with a, you know, with a pleading on the other side. You know, that's, they're called this kind of a thing. They're called a third-party defendant now. If I asked you about the process, that's what it would look like. Okay? All right, so I would always say start with standard, then do process. But it's up to you, whatever you feel more comfortable with. That's that last one. So hopefully you kind of get a sense for how these things work. How do you optimize your points, making sure you know going in that you have at least a block. I can state, if Rule 14 is an issue, I can state the is or may be liable to me for all or part of the claim against me. I have that. Then you're going to get the rule points. You won't miss them. Even if you miss the ultimate answer, you're going to get those. So things like that can really hedge your score, really help you out. The next big tip is we reference, pull the facts from the exam and use those facts. If there's facts in there that you're not using, it's not my exam. I don't tend to have a lot of extraneous facts. I try to. Some of it has to be contextual so you know what's going on. But the majority of facts I try to put in there because I want to see them. I like to see them. I'm trying to get you to use them. So make sure you do. All right, let's finish up with the extra questions I got. And what we don't cover, I will post on TWEN. All right. I got a couple questions about, I'm trying to find the other one, about diversity stuff. And I'll tell you again, if you're in a, like, stressing about subject matter jurisdiction, don't, because it's not the focus of this exam. It's just, are the claims for between opposing parties of people of diverse citizenship. That's really it. The only extra one was in Rule 14.
that the defendant and pleading people do not have to have diversity. They could be from the same state. But again, like, that's not, I'm really not focusing on that. So don't worry about that. Scare those two. The other question I had about one was like coverage. Like, they gave me a list of rules. They're all about the admiralty things, advisory juries. I'll list these on Twan and tell you, no, we're not going to worry about them. So sometimes like one extra rule. If I had you read all of 19, for example, 19C, I've gotten a couple questions. So we have to know that because it's about like extraneous things, admiralty rules, whatnot. No. Okay, but I will post these ones that you have that list. And any others, let me know. What I generally don't answer is, like, how much do I have to know it in any variation of that question? Just because I can't. And people are really creative, but no, I'm not going to answer that. The second one that we'll cover now is about 55, since we didn't talk about that now. And no, I let you know earlier, I am posting an example old test question from Gillis about 55, so that you'll have another one to look at. But this was default judgments, and just to kind of go over the generic process and what does it mean to fail to appear, or I'm sorry, appear but still be defaulting, what does that mean? Remember, default judgment is in two parts. You get your entry of default under 55A, and then you get the default judgment under 55B. An entry of default, you can submit with the clerk of court stating that the defendant failed to plead or otherwise defend. And the question I got was, well, what does it mean to otherwise defend, have failure to otherwise defend? Well, remember, you can do like a motion to dismiss, and that counts as an appearance and not being in default. But there's a certain point in time where you're not otherwise defending any longer. So you file a Rule 12B motion to dismiss. You're defendant. You're otherwise defendant. We say, no, motion denied. You wait around and wait around and wait around and never file an answer and never do anything. Now you are no longer otherwise defending. Now you're in default. So you kind of have to look at that point in time. Are they pleading or are they otherwise defending? You realize at a certain point in time, your otherwise defending is no longer valid. We deny your motion. You have to do something else. You can't just wait. So assuming you get your entry of default, then the next question is, can I get default judgment? And that's itself a two-part test. Can I go to the clerk? Can I go to the court? You can go to the clerk in very limited situations. If the sum is certain or can be made certain, you need to have something. If I get this in your fact pattern, it has to be something you can actually calculate. You'll see numbers there somehow or a way to get to the numbers. That's the first part. You also have to have a total fail to appear.
So if you were one of those people that filed that motion to dismiss and waited and waited, you're not totally failed to appear. Those are the kinds of people who appear but later default. Just doing anything, writing a letter to the court, writing a letter to the other party, any of that counts as an appearance, but won't be enough to save you from defaulting. It will just now get you past the clerk for the entry of judgment is to the court now. And the last thing, you can't be an incompetent or minor and get judgment from the clerk. Okay? So first big step, can I get entry of default from the clerk? Fail to plead, answer. Fail to otherwise defend. Go into a motion or get denied and wait. Second, once I get that, who do I get entry of judgment from? Clerk, if it's some certain or can be calculated, not incompetent or a minor, and never ever appear at all in any way, shape, or form. Otherwise, go to the court. And that's really that. So there's not a whole lot of application there. That's not one where you're going to see a lot of facts you have to discuss. It really is. The big ones, did they appear at all ever? And is it a sum certain? That's pretty much the big ones you're trying to issue spot with those. That was what I hit on default. I'm going to deal with the rest of the judgment, the motion questions, and then we'll get back to party joinder for the other last two I have. Okay. Is the granting of summary judgment interlocutory or appealable? It's a final judgment if you get a grant of summary judgment because it means you win. And so it's appealable. Under 50A, can both parties move for that first, remember, judgment is a matter of law, you have to move under 50A and then you renew under 50B? So this is a question about that first motion under 50A. Can both parties move during the closing argument since the case has yet to go to the jury? And the answer is yes. It's just before submission to the jury. So you can wait during that argument time. Second, during trial, can the defendant only make the motion after the plaintiff rests, or do they have to wait till the plaintiff has a chance to rebut? The answer is once they rest their case in chief, you can move for judgment as a matter of law because they've been heard on that issue.
We had that with, like, the timeline on the slide. I would just go back and make sure. I gave you, actually, each section that people raise it at. As long as you're comfortable with those, that's it. Like, I'm not going to make up a new one. That's the times you move. So that one's good. And that's a good pro forma question because it's you need it to be able to do the 50B. All right. What's this one? Okay. I have that one already. That one. All right, here's another one on another Rule 50 question. What's the standard when the court is granting a judgment as a matter of law? How do they look at the things? Remember, 50 is about getting an actual judgment, so you can't invade the jury. So it's only you can get it if no reasonable jury can conclude other than for, you know, the moving party, and you construe everything against the moving party. So if the non-moving party could have potentially, like, won through an inference of facts, you have to use that inference in their favor. You can't question credibility. You're not reweighing evidence. It's about look at everything, infer everything in favor of the non-moving party. Could no reasonable jury, with all the inferences in their favor, still rule for the moving party. That's what it is. That's judgment as a matter of law. All right. Last two, and then we're done. Actually, we already answered that one. Rule 23, in this is class actions. You want to put this one under your party joinder one. They want some clarification on how can you certify a class. Well, they're right in their proposed answer. It's two parts. First, you want to see that the prerequisites for all class actions under 23A is met. Then you figure out which type of class you are under 23B. All right, and that's what it is. Make sure you have those parts. Unless, like, sometimes I'll limit a question in some way where I'll say the party here is just saying they don't meet the prerequisites, then all you need to do is address that piece. Or multiple choice questions sometimes do that. Do they meet 23A? Yes or no for these reasons. All right. I'm going to be posting the instructions on TWEN soon when the upload gets ready for you, so you'll see kind of the breakout, how many questions, that kind of stuff, and read it beforehand so you feel more comfortable with it. I'll tell you, every year, there are students who take it because of conflicts with other exams or illness outside of the time of the exam. And so do not discuss the exam. It's considered an honor code violation. Discuss the exam outside of the room of the exam, in part because you might be talking, like, I saw Fred in class, and Fred and I are talking about it, but you're in the commissary, and there's people who haven't taken the exam, or in your class that you didn't know, so just don't talk about it. In fact, if you're one of those people who has to talk about the exam, and I was never one of those people, I didn't like having people talk about the exam personally, but I know there's people out there that need to, you know, don't be anywhere where you can be overheard. You're going to be in trouble. It only hurts you to talk about the exam, and then someone else is sitting there hearing about the exam, all right? And I will send an email when I know everyone's taken it if you want to know. Okay, just don't. Just don't. All right, any other questions I can answer for you now? Yeah?
Rule 20.
Just in general about the exam. Do you have any more specific? Yeah, because it's like on the flyer here. There's probably lots of those. Just post those on Twine. No, that's great.
Okay, clarification. On Twine, are you going to be posting a list of all the rules and subsections that we're responsible for? Or is that just
it's the syllabus. But there has been a couple questions that people have said, like, we spent time in this and into the subsection. If you have a question, list it and I will tell you.
So 39 and 48,
we did get to 39 and 48 as far as jury trials go, and I posted the answers to the slides there. Like I said before, that is like skim level. I mean, stick with the two main areas, which is claim joiner, party joiner, motions to dismiss. I'm not going to have like a big jury trial question on the exam. And that doesn't mean there's any, you know, I swear there's nothing, but at that level. Like, it's a skim level. But we did get to it, and everything on those slides, I actually literally went in and wrote the answers out and posted them. So if you can see that, that's all you need to know. But if you have a question about any other subsection, just post it and I'll tell you. To the extent I can. All right? Okay. Go and do well.